Hey, it's Jamie, and welcome to episode 3 of You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. As with the last two, this episode was recorded in the waning days of 2020 before we'd even given this podcast a name. Strap in and enjoy our discussion about Aquaman and Lambrusco, which is not, in fact, champagne, no matter what stupid shit Scott says. Do us a favor and please rate, review, and subscribe. Follow us on all social media platforms at Bigger Bottle Pod, and please forgive Scott his audio sins in this episode. He promises to do better.
My question is, how many of this current crop of DC movies, so like your post-Christopher Nolan Batman movies, everything from Man of Steel in 2013 on, how many of them have you seen? You've seen none of them.
Zero.
So you have not seen Man of Steel?
Correct.
You have not seen Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice?
That is correct.
You have not seen Suicide Squad?
That is also correct.
A movie that no one liked, made $800 million, and now there is a sequel slash soft reboot that is one of the more anticipated movies of the year.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, no, I did not see
it. You have not seen Wonder Woman?
Correct.
You have now seen Aquaman twice. You have not seen Shazam?
Yep.
And you have not seen Birds of Prey or The Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn?
Nope.
No. Okay, so then I'm really just talking to the audience here.
Hello. I'm Scott. I used to manage operations for movie theaters and for the Philadelphia Film Festival. And then the pandemic came along, and after 10 years, I ain't got no job no more. So I'm staying at home and being a dad and watching a ton of movies. Jamie, introduce yourself.
I'm Jamie. I'm a wine guy in Philly. I've been running restaurants in and around Philadelphia for about 10 years and was laid off on March 16th, the same way many of us were. And so I am staying at home and drinking a lot of wine and cutting that wine these days with movies that Scott has recommended.
That is correct. We're staying home. In part because we have to, and in part because we all have to. And I'm watching movies, and Jamie is drinking. And anytime we talk to anybody, or anytime I talk to anybody, they're like, oh yeah, I just wish they'd release all those new movies that they're trying to save for theaters on Disney Plus, so that we'd have something to watch. To which I scream into the void, there's so much to watch. Hence this podcast. We will recommend movies to you that are already available on your streaming services, and Jamie will pair them with wines that are readily available at a number of major retailers and distributors.
I'd like to note your everyman voice is your impression of everyone.
Of the everyman, of the salt, yes, of the earth people. I just want to watch the content.
I know those people.
We are here today to talk about Aquaman.
Yes.
Now, Jamie, you had seen this movie previously at my urging, right?
Yeah, you gave me a list. I went up to New York to work Harvest, and I knew that I was going to have like some evenings available to movie watch. And I asked you for some recommendations, among them some of my favorite watches in the last couple of years. Palm Springs, love that movie.
Palm Springs is so much fun. We might do Palm Springs at some point.
That would be a fun one to pair a movie to. Also, the one that you tagged in your email to me as all the way the fuck up my alley was Sorry to Bother You.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's a Jamie movie right there.
I love it. So good. Anyway, so I was a little skeptical because I just don't love the superhero movies as of late. But the Marvel one sort of got boring for me around Avengers 9 or whatever.
There have been four. That's unreasonable. There have been four.
Jesus Christ. Anyway, so I had seen it, you mentioned it, and I was definitely down because it's a whole blast, and I knew exactly what wine needed to go with it. So, today we're drinking Lambrusco.
Lambrusco.
Lambrusco, yeah. If you're a boomer and you're listening, you would recognize the word Lambrusco because you've probably had Riuniti, which is the brand that ruined the region. The famous slogan was Riuniti on ice, Riuniti so nice. It's just kind of a thing that we know about in the wine community because we've now gotten excited again about Lambrusco. So a couple of years ago, I bought a bottle of Riuniti, and I swear to God, I got a headache after the first glass. That shit is vile. It's so bad.
What's it cost? Like $7.50 a bottle?
I believe it was $7.99 on the shelf.
So wait.
Which is too much. I would pay you $7.99 to keep it the fuck away from me.
So they took this sparkling red wine and poured it over ice. Was that the recommended way to serve it?
Yeah, well, because what they were making was garbage and it needed to be chilled and diluted in order to be palatable.
And this was what, in the 70s, the 80s, that the boomers were gobbling this
up? Yeah, that is correct. Millions of gallons of it were made, and there's still a bunch of it that's made. But there's sort of a resurgence in interest in the category now. And a lot of younger farmers and winemakers are trying to make wines that are a little bit more compelling. It comes from a producer called Denny Binney, who's an organic farmer on the Emilia side of Emilia-Romagna. Emilia-Romagna is one of the provinces of Italy, has long been one of the most wealthy areas of Europe. It's fun fact where Bugatti, Ferrari, Lamborghini, and Maserati call home.
The companies or the people?
The companies. So it's a very, very wealthy area. It had for a long time been sort of maligned to cheap industrial production wines like Riuniti. So now you've got a bunch of young people who are taking over their family's estates, not selling the grapes to larger companies, making their own wines. And here we are with Denny Binney. He's a younger guy. He makes a bunch of wines that are like super geeky and what you would call like terroir specific, single vineyard, single variety kind of stuff. This wine though has been affectionately nicknamed Festa, which means party.
Festa.
This is the party wine.
It tastes like a party.
This is the kind of wine that I would, you know, if I was throwing a party, I would feel comfortable just grabbing a case of this and not really worrying about much else. I can't imagine a lot of people not liking this.
All right, now I have two glass options here, James. We should definitely consider this. I have a very tasteful champagne flute, and I also have just like a regular-ass Costco brand party pack of all-purpose wine glasses.
I would like to take this moment for a public service announcement. Flutes are garbage. Don't ever fucking use them.
Why are flutes garbage? Even champagne flutes? This is a champagne, right? It's sparkling, therefore it's champagne.
I'll kill you. No, we use wine glasses for wine.
We use wine glasses for wine. So this is
and
wine.
And you put it in a wine glass.
And this is a wine glass. Can you confirm what I'm holding here?
I can confirm that that is a wine glass.
One might call this a red wine glass. Is that correct?
I would call that an all-purpose wine glass.
That's what I like. Ooh, this color is beautiful.
Yeah, I've already been sipping on it. I am enjoying myself.
Let me give you my impressions.
Yeah.
My off the cuff. I have not previously tried this. I was warned by you last night that if I didn't want it to go flat for our discussion today, that I should not open it, not having a champagne cork, which thus confirms for me that this is, in fact, champagne.
God damn it. I'm going to get you a champagne stopper so that you can, like, store shit, because you don't drink a bottle when you open a bottle, which is weird.
Yeah, I don't drink the whole bottle. I don't uncork a bottle and then immediately pour the entire thing into my gullet.
I fundamentally don't understand the words that are coming
out
of your mouth.
You're like Barney Gumble, Jamie. You're like a cartoon drunk. Let me see. What are we getting here? Let's see what the old sniffer says.
Oh my God, you're taking so long.
I have no precise mechanism for detecting these flavors and scents.
You have a nose with an olfactory bulb connected to the olfactory centers of your brain. Fucking.
I think the bulb is a little dim.
Yeah, I think that that is true.
It's very lively. It's obviously fruity. There's a bit of that astringency on the finish. What else we got? I'm detecting hints of slightly overripe lemon rind. I've got a scotch of melted asphalt. I'm feeling some shoe leather, but not real shoe leather, like metaphorical shoe leather, like, you know, like you're doing the work kind of shoe leather. You know what I'm saying? Like Columbo shoe leather, you know, like shoe leather.
Like the shoe leather of lore.
No, not of lore. I didn't say mythological. The term shoe leather is a metaphor that refers to the effort based on direct action or literally walking around and meeting with people. Okay, it's that kind of shoe leather I'm detecting.
You smell that in the you smell metaphor in the wine, like the aliens on Star Trek.
Yes, exactly.
Darmok and Jalad at Lambrusco.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Jamie and Lambrusco collapsed in a men's room floor.
That's just a real thing that has happened in real life.
I was there.
You were not there.
So those are my initial takes, and then let me hit you. I'm going to hit you with it here.
Hit me with, I don't know what it is.
Are you ready?
I'm ready. Sure.
So, James Rubin, can you name...
Oh, God.
Wine Follies, 5 primary flavors of Lambrusco. 5 Here we primary go flavors. Here we go again.
Black cherry, strawberry. It just tastes like black cherries and strawberries. We'll go with roses and violets and plums.
Roses and violets and plums. Again, remind me. Is this what you think the primary flavors are, or what you think Wine Folly thinks the primary flavors are?
This is what I think the primary
What you think the primary flavors are. Black cherry, strawberry, roses, violets, and plums.
Yep.
Now, winefolly.com, drum roll.
We're not doing a drum roll.
All right. I'll add in a drum roll later. Strawberry, blackberry, not black cherry, rhubarb, hibiscus, and, for the wild card slot, potting soil. Because of course, potting soil. Definitely something that we've all tasted before and has an identifiable, you know, flavor profile that you would want in food and beverage.
You haven't tasted potting soil?
No, I've never eaten potting soil before.
Like not even a little, not even like a little dab on your finger?
No.
Just on the tip of your tongue?
Oh my God.
A little dab will do you?
I don't even know if this is a bit. I really can't tell. Like, maybe you have. I mean, like, I'm sure you ate dirt when you were a kid, but, like, I don't know.
No. As an adult, I have absolutely tasted potting soil, and it's fully because of this wine bullshit that I'm immersed in.
What other absurd things have you consumed just so that, to enhance your profile?
I've licked rocks.
I've licked rocks.
Yes.
Well, what kind of rocks? Like a lot of rocks? Have you done like a taste test with rocks?
Like river rocks. Yeah.
Oh, man. You people are so gross.
I'm just trying to get better at what I do. That's all.
All right. What else do you want to say about this wine? Because I'm... River rocks.
Here's the thing about this wine. Do you think it's tasty? You like it?
I do. I think it's super tasty. It's bubbly and light. Great. It's airy. It's not unpleasant.
And that's exactly what this wine is here to do. It's party wine. While we could sit here and wax philosophical about this wine, it doesn't beg us to do that.
Right.
It just kind of begs us to drink it.
Just like Aquaman. Aquaman requires us to ask no questions about what is... Oh, beneath the surface. Sorry. First of many ocean puns.
Yes, it's easy, it's enjoyable, it's surface level. Get you see what I did there?
It's going to keep happening.
Right on the surface.
It's going to keep happening.
Yeah, it's just fucking tasty. And yes, the area of Emilia and Lambrusco producers do make wines that are more terroir expressive and compelling in like an intellectual way, but they all sort of lean this direction. That's the unifying thing about Lambrusco, is that it's just get a bunch of pizzas and a couple of bottles of Lambrusco and have a good time with your friends.
Yeah, it immediately smells like party. I say this not as a pejorative, but it tastes like, you know, you're at a, I don't know, drunken New Year's party and somebody's going around like, who wants champagne? And some drunk idiot holds up their glass of red wine and just like, just top me off. And then they pour, you know, fucking whatever the...
Yeah.
I have many questions for you. My first is, this is a sparkling red wine. Is Lambrusco the only sparkling red wine?
No.
Okay.
It's easily the most famous one. Second place would probably be sparkling Shiraz from Australia.
Sparkling
it's
Shiraz.
Like category. Ooh. Yeah, they're tasty. They don't as much reach American shores. The Aussies like to drink it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then like scattered sort of around the world, different producers will do like a bubbly whatever they've got.
Now, why is it that white is the one that we sparkle and red is the one that we tend not to sparkle?
From a flavor point of view, tannins can sort of conflict with the bubbles. Just on your tongue. You feel like a little bit of tannin on this wine.
Yeah, a little bit.
But if there was any more, it might be kind of distracting and weird with the bubbles. The other thing is that making a sparkling wine requires very clear, clean juice, which is typically not the case when you're making a red wine, just because making a red wine means you have to include the skins in your fermentation process. So to then like fine and filter everything out and re-ferment either in bottle or tank to make bubbles, it's much more of a process. Also, there isn't like a huge market for it. People like sparkling white wine.
But Lambrusco is having a resurgence now.
It is. Among sort of the natural wine set, but also just people who like easy, drinkable wines. The other thing about sort of the resurgence of Lambrusco is it is sort of centered around organic and biodynamic farming and sustainable agriculture, sort of the responsible production, which is a thing that I hold very dear to my heart.
Responsible production.
Yeah.
Is that the only thing that you're in favor of responsible action on? Because otherwise you're pretty reckless and deranged in your takes on things.
I'm reckless and deranged personally, but I think that I stand pretty firmly in defense of the planet.
All right. All right. There's one thing. Come on. You recycle. It doesn't mean your recycling company recycles.
Yeah, that's so fucking true. It's maddening.
It's the, like...
Maddening.
Go ahead, and then I'll say my thing.
No, you say your thing, because my thing is just like shouting out that my household has a lower carbon footprint than...
Oh, shut the fuck up. Shut up. I don't care. It doesn't matter if you have a low carbon footprint, because as we all found out earlier this year, and then immediately forgot, because 2020 was just a string of tragedies and outrages, is that apparently all the major plastics companies have known forever that there was no cost-effective way to recycle plastic, and so that no one's actually been doing it for 30 years. And we all just moved on.
I remember.
So fuck you and your low carbon footprint. I'm putting milk bottles in the trash now.
Man,
it doesn't even matter. It doesn't matter.
I'm out here trying. That's it. All right. So last couple of things to say about this wine.
Yeah.
You know, it's made to be a party in a bottle. We've already said that. If you're looking to pair it with food, I said pizza earlier. I think pizza is like sort of a classic thing to do, or has become a classic thing to do here in America. But over in Emilia-Romagna, just the sort of meats and cheeses of the area. This is where Modena and Bologna and Parma are. So Parmigiana, prosciutto, culatello, like all of the cured meats and cheeses are great with this wine.
Mm.
And I could go for a wheel of Parm right now. That sounds amazing.
The whole wheel.
The whole wheel. Maybe with a little balsamico del Modena. That would be wonderful.
The whole bottle.
Yeah. Don't fucking question me. I'll drink a whole bottle of balsamic vinegar.
Oh, it's so gross. Why
this wine
do the
can be found?
Go ahead.
Wait, you got one more question.
Why do the sparklings pair so well with garbage food? Like you always pair champagne with fried chicken, right? Why is the Lambrusco good with pizza and the bottle says burgers? Like why is that? Why bubbles with starches and salts and fried fatty foods?
Well, so I've said to you before that acid cuts fat.
Yes.
And that's one of like the basic pairing tenets. So dissolved CO2 is carbonic acid. So it's extra acid. So the greasier the food, the easier it's... So the texture of the bubbles themselves cut the fat, but also the extra acid from the carbonic acid.
And when we say cut the fat, like I don't mean to be asking you like rudimentary, baby questions.
No, but you
here.
Do.
If you were to say to me it undercuts the fat, I feel like I would understand what that means. But like it cuts it, like the fat is
it.
What I want when I have, you know, a greasy fucking slice of pizza or some fried chicken.
Yeah, that's exactly what I want too. But do you want it like after you take a bite or after you finish that drumstick?
Yeah.
Of fried chicken, that beautiful fried drumstick with maybe a little bit too much breading and some oil seeped into it, and it's salty and yummy. Do you want that grease to lay on your tongue, or do you want maybe a Coca-Cola to wash it from your mouth?
Are we talking about cleansing one's palate here? Is that what cutting is about? Cutting is about cleansing the palate and replacing it with something complementary.
It cuts through the acid. Yes, you're
just
removing...
using the word I'm asking you to explain.
God damn it! Yes, I will. Yes, it is removing the acid, the fat from your palate, and replacing it with something more pleasant on a longer term. I used Coca-Cola specifically because that is a very, very high acid product.
Right. I also think that Lambrusco goes extremely well with Aquaman, I will say. Very, very well paired, James.
Yeah, I think it's perfect. I couldn't. As I was watching it last night, I lamented not having an extra bottle of Lambrusco around, because I knew that we wanted to drink this together. And let's talk about this big, dumb Aquaman.
It is dumb. It's real dumb. Aquaman is so incredibly unlikely. That is the thing that I think I admire most about it, is how unlikely it is and how...
What do you mean by unlikely? Because it doesn't seem unlikely to me.
So I think it stands out on its own in the current glut of superhero movies, which is one of the things, one of the reasons why I wanted to recommend it. One of the other reasons I wanted to recommend it is because its reputation, strictly on the premise of we made an Aquaman movie, and also on it's another DC movie, which after the critically disdained and largely unpopular, like Batman v Superman and Man of Steel and Suicide Squad, that audiences largely reject despite all of them making a lot of money. After all of that, like, people wrote off Aquaman. Wonder Woman was seen as a blip and the only good thing going on at the Warner Brothers DC side, and everybody wrote off Aquaman and thought it was going to be stupid, and they were right, except that it's also great.
So it's unlikely because it's not, because DC has been sort of branded as not good in the movie world?
It's unlikely for that reason. It's unlikely because of just how bug fuck weird it is. Like, for a movie that is as, like, very much feels at times like it's written by committee, that sense that I was talking about before, where it feels like it wants to satisfy every possible audience. And so to do that, it's constantly shifting genres and tones just to make people happy. It opens with a silly Jules Verne quote. It's a mermaid romance novel. It's a fish out of water. It has crazy rad action. It's super sincere and earnest about the family stuff. It doesn't try to be any other kind of superhero movie other than asking this real deep question, which is, what will make a specific Aquaman movie? And what makes that work with Jason Momoa as the thing that the entire movie is built around? And I think the whole film is calibrated to his persona. His, like, swagger, strut, surfer dude, my man! His whole attitude. The entire movie is built from, this is the center, and we have to build something that he will act as a counterpoint around it.
Yeah, I think that I can agree with that. I want to just point out I think this is further evidence to your point of the extreme Momoa-ness of this whole movie. Very early on, we have our first action sequence, which is...
Well, you're talking about the second action scene now. You're talking about the one on the submarine.
On the submarine,
he stops
the super cool
sea pirates from, or he tries to stop them from hijacking a Russian sub.
That's correct.
Which rules.
But during that sequence, he says, I'm late for happy hour because of this. And then in the next scene, he goes to happy hour, which is fantastic. And then you have the bit where his dad can still drink heavier than he can. But the thing that I love is, even having seen this before, when the, like, biker dudes approach him from behind, the gag still worked on me. And I was like, oh God, they're going to, this is a bar fight scene. And he pulls out a pink iPhone. Can we do pictures? At first, Jason Momoa is not about it in the first couple of pictures. And then by the end, he's obviously had, like, a number of drinks and is doing the dumb drunk face that you do in selfies, which I have done a lot. That's your nail in the coffin, that this is, like, this is a Jason Momoa joint almost.
So let me hit you with my list of insane things featured very briefly in this movie, many of which I would watch an entire feature-length film about.
Okay, please do.
As we already said, the selfie montage of Momoa Aquaman getting rowdy with a bunch of bar hooligans. I would watch a 90-minute, you know, $500,000, like, super indie Steven Soderbergh shot on an iPhone movie about that. I would watch a whole movie of just Momoa hanging out with, like, salt-of-the-earth dock workers and just getting drunk and talking about global super politics.
Yes, absolutely.
Roughly 20 minutes into the movie, the first time we see any of Atlantis, we are introduced to Dolph Lundgren, king of one of the Atlantean kingdoms, riding a giant armored seahorse. Then Patrick Wilson riding a giant armored super croc, followed by Willem Dafoe on a giant armored hammerhead shark.
Yes.
All of that rules, and I would watch a whole movie about giant sea creature animal husbandry for, like, their super beasts of burden. I would watch a full HBO miniseries, yeah, about the person who works in the stables, and, like, he got his leg bit off by a croc, and now he's gonna have an uprising. Before the first big trident fight between Momoa and Patrick Wilson's King Orm, there is an octopus drummer. There is an octopus who plays the war drums in, like, an undersea volcano glowing red-hot trench.
Yes. Drumming Octopus, I'm all the way on board with the Drumming Octopus. I feel like this is not the first drummer octopus to be featured in a movie.
Do you know what the other one is?
I don't. But I know that image sticks in my head. Is it Finding
it's
Nemo?
No, it's The Little Mermaid. There's an octopus who plays the drums in Under the Sea.
1,000,000% on board with the giant drum playing octopus. And I would watch a concert film about his band.
Yeah, exactly. Octopus drummer should be the co-lead of Aquaman 2. The plot.
The plot.
Can you, James Rubin...
Can I summarize the plot?
Which there is a lot of.
Okay, so the plot is basically you've got Aquaman. So he's the son of Atlanta, who's the queen of Atlantis.
Played by a digitally de-aged Nicole Kidman.
He's the bastard son, and he knows how to control his Atlantean powers because of Willem Dafoe, who it is revealed later on has taught him the ways of Atlantis.
Willem Dafoe, who is the lead advisor.
The Grand Vizier.
Grand Vizier to the current king of Atlantis, Orm, played, I think, masterfully by Patrick Wilson. He knows, he is so dialed in. He knows exactly what this movie is. And he knows that the more seriously he plays it, which is what he needs to as the straight man villain, the more straight he plays it, the funnier it is.
And he plays it really fucking straight.
Yeah.
And it must be really hard to play that straight up against Momoa's Aquaman.
Or just when you're wearing that costume and having to shout, "I am the Ocean Master!" Orm wants to wage war on the surface dwellers because we're all terrible and we're destroying the planet and the oceans. You got us there, King Orm of Atlantis.
Absolutely have us there. And I wrote down a little note here, which is the parallel between King Orm and Prince Nuada of Hellboy 2.
Of Hellboy 2. That's good. Yeah.
And I think Prince Nuada is a much more compelling character. They play into Prince Nuada having a point and being right about how humans are garbage.
Yeah. Orm doesn't really get that.
Yeah. Aquaman completely ignores the fact that Orm is pretty much right.
Yeah.
That the surface dwellers, us, need to go.
Yeah. He dumps all of our warships and our garbage back onto the beaches around the world. It's a pretty audacious opening gambit in your war on the surface.
It is. And honestly, fair.
You say Nuada, I would also say Killmonger in Black Panther, the Michael B. Jordan character, who is the villain, but who is right, and who by the end of the movie changes the hero's mind.
I did not see it.
Really? It's good. It's real good.
Really? I'll watch it.
I think it's more important than it's good, but it's real good. But yeah, Orm is totally correct, but instead, because he's such a sneering villain, you get the sense that he doesn't care about being right about his war on the surface. He just wants a justification for, him seizing power.
That's exactly right.
It's not, nuanced politics, but it works. It totally plays in the context of the movie.
It does. So Orm wants to wage war. Aquaman would probably stand against that, but doesn't initially until Amber Heard as Mira.
Princess of one of the many Atlantean kingdoms, daughter to King What's-His-Name, played by Dolph Lundgren, who has a red and silver floating underwater beard that is amazing.
Which is fantastic, yes. She comes to Aquaman asking him for help, is quickly rebuffed. But then what we said, that first attack happens, he agrees to help, and we sort of follow Orm in his, political quest to grab power.
Right.
And we haven't even mentioned the secondary antagonist of the movie, Black Manta.
Yo, Black Manta rules.
I was not on board fully with Black Manta until my second viewing.
No!
My first viewing, I was like, this is silly and doesn't need to be here. He's not important. He's not interesting.
Did that change with your second viewing?
Yeah, just because he rules. I still don't think he's particularly interesting.
I think the performance makes him work so well. And I think the movie actually does. There's some smart writing to really make that character work and to make you invested in him. He's a classic Aquaman villain who is one of the undersea super pirates that we're introduced to in the first major action sequence of the movie. He's played by Yahya Abdul-Mateen, who, Jamie, have you watched Watchmen yet? The HBO series?
No.
but he's in that. He's in the recent Netflix film, the Aaron Sorkin Trial of the Chicago 7. He plays Bobby Seals, the Black Panther leader, who is one of...
Oh my God, I don't know why I didn't draw that line. Yeah, he was great as Bobby Seal.
They do a really smart thing early in the movie, which is, again, meat and potatoes, basic action movie, high drama, right? So it's him and his pirate dad raiding this sub. The Aquaman shows up, beats the piss out of all of their henchmen, kills the dad. He pleads with him, Aquaman, help me save my father and ask the sea for mercy. And he just pieces out like
the dad killed himself, essentially. But I thought that was really interesting because, like, the Black Manta holds Aquaman responsible for his dad's death. But Aquaman didn't actually kill the motherfucker. Like, he's...
And then, like, later on, Aquaman unpacks that and he's like, I could have handled that differently. Like, what am I thinking? Who am I in my life? Like, I brought this violence on myself. He's a totally compelling secondary villain. And the performance is great. And then when he shows up later in his new Atlantean armor, looking like the fucking comic book character who has the dumbest costume ever, where he's just in, like, black super Power Ranger body armor with a gigantic...
Frogman helmet.
Perfect. Huge frogman helmet with glowing red eyes that shoot mega laser beams out of them. They don't try to make his suit like, how do we take Black Manta and try and make it grounded and realistic? Like, it's so unafraid to be a comic book, to be bright and colorful and silly, but it takes itself mostly seriously internal to that. Like,
speaking of that, the Black Manta sequence... in whatever Italian city where they, like, figure out what they're
in. It's Sicily.
They're in Sicily somewhere. Of course, they end up in a wine shop.
Oh, yeah. And then Mira does her super rad thing. I thought you'd like that.
Of course I love that. It's great. Like, it's kind of silly that it doesn't happen in places where there is water nearby.
Right.
She only, like, realizes that she can make killing... death spears out of wine.
Yeah.
But not like when she's near a body of water or in a body of water. However, super fucking awesome, like screams and breaks all of the bottles and then there's
and
a
then with
a
her,
whole...
her water kinesis or hydrokinesis powers, she takes all of the liquid, I think exclusively red wine, and forms it into spinning conical spears that skewers all of the remaining Aqua Power Ranger bad guys in it.
Yep.
I keep saying Power Rangers. It's important to me that our audience knows that I do not care about Power Rangers. Even as a 9-year-old, I was too cool for that. I'm not referencing them for any nostalgic reason or that it's a base reference for me. They look like Power Ranger characters. Like,
I would just like to take a moment to mention here that while I didn't know you when you were 9 years old, I did know you when you were 12 years old, and you were most certainly not too cool for the Power Rangers. You just thought you were.
I was too cool for the Power Rangers. I was not cool.
You were not.
I was not cool at any age in my life, but I have always been cooler than Power Rangers, which I think basically stinks and is dumb.
The Power Rangers rule, and we will get into a fight about this another time.
For sure. We are now in spoiler territory, by the way. If you have not watched this silly movie and we have somehow convinced you to watch it and you are concerned about major plot points, here be the spoilers. I'm warning you. Nicole Kidman returns to the movie after having been absent for 90 minutes. She has been alive for 20 years alone at the core of the Earth in the Hidden Sea, surrounded by dinosaurs, wearing as battle armor the exoskeletons of the bipedal crustacean monsters who chased her there. She comes back only to tell Arthur about the, like, super kaiju. I forget the name of it.
The Karathan.
A super kaiju the size of a skyscraper who is voiced by Julie Andrews. This is the greatest movie anyone's ever made. I'm sorry. It's dumber than a bag of hammers. It doesn't have anything to say about the human condition. It is exquisitely crafted while being totally artless. It has Julie Andrews voicing a kaiju that is tamed by Jason Momoa's psychic powers. Nothing better has ever happened on screen.
Like, in the next scene, this Julie Andrews kaiju emerges from the ocean to do massive, what looks like a space battle, but it is under the ocean.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Like, high in the running for best space battles in film history, and it does not take place
in space. It's the climax of Aquaman. That is a hot take, but a very interesting one.
And I want to be very clear, the reason I'm calling it a space battle is they behave like it's a space battle. It's like, it's dogfighting with lasers, and that, like, it just, it, the physics of it feel like a space battle, and the gigantic wide shots where everything is like super angular and perspective driven.
Yeah.
It just feels like a space battle. It's also worth noting that at the end of this battle, there's the climactic fight on top of the submarine between Orm and Arthur. And at the end of it, Orm is shown mercy, which is a little silly considering the thousands of Atlanteans that were just killed.
What?
In this fucking huge battle. This is the one responsible. He's the one who deserved to die. Kill him.
Yeah, but it's not his way. It's not his way. My man. Yeah.
No, it's his way. We kill the red shirts, right, but not anyone who has lives.
That's what red shirts are for. Is for being dispatched with in mass numbers.
It's made explicit in this movie when Mera says that only the highborn can breathe both air and water.
I was hoping you would bring this up. I thought your performative wokeness would not allow you to leave this by the wayside.
Oh, go fuck yourself. There's nothing performative. There's a lot of things performative about my wokeness, but it is not. Fucking, I'm not going to defend myself to you.
Fair.
You motherfucker.
Fair. But yes, so Mira very clearly states that only the highborn Atlanteans can breathe air, which when she kills some of those guys, the Power Ranger dudes who have to walk around in these big armored suits filled with water so they can breathe. Not long after she makes that statement, she kills one of those guys by like cracking his visor and pulling all the water out, which is like,
yep,
man, check your privilege, girl. He can't even breathe out of there. That's not right. It's classist. It's totally classist. And she is not aware of her highborn Atlantean race privilege.
Yes, that is correct. It's pretty rough to hear because, like, it does trigger that, like, that wokeness in us that's like, wait, this doesn't. When you say highborn, I don't like when you say
that. Yeah, it doesn't sound nice. I don't appreciate that. I know you guys have been at the bottom of the sea for a few thousand years, but you should check out Twitter and see the takes.
Couldn't anybody be king at this point? Does it have to be? It has to be someone. Okay, cool. It's got to be someone from.
It's got to be by the bloodlines.
And this also ties into like what we loved about The Last Jedi, which was that legacy doesn't in fact matter. And that you can be anyone and make a difference. And Aquaman completely ignores that, or rather flies directly in the face of it.
It is very much your typical, like, what the modern Hollywood version of Campbell's hero's journey has turned that into, which is like, you have to be special, right? It's the thing that the Lego movie so effectively tears apart. You're the special. You're the one.
Right.
Only you, because of your genetic lineage or because of your bloodline or the place where you were born, only you are the one who can fix the plot. And it very much suffers from that. It doesn't bother me as much because, not that the character is so well drawn, but that the Momoa personality, his what Campbell called the resistance to the call or the reluctance to the call, his feels sincere. I believe that Momoa does not want to step up and be a hero, not because the plot requires him to not want to take on the crown or not want to take on the fucking trident, but because that dude's attitude. He wants to hang out and drink beers with his dad and kick the shit out of submarine pirates.
Right. He does that for fun and, like, because it's sort of the right thing to do.
Do you think he has a job?
Quick digression. Joseph Campbell is full of shit. To his whole point that, like, the universal hero is just a, like, a reductive result of our common experiences as humans, completely ignores the cultural significance of certain particular heroes, and also ignores the differences. He cherry picks to get to his conclusion anyway. Fuck Joseph Campbell, hot take.
His conclusions have also been, like, have been wildly flattened. You know, like, a lot of people took the lessons of Star Wars to say, like, we just need to keep doing what Campbell did. And then they'll say it in interviews. Oh, well, we're going back to what, you know, when George Lucas looked at Joseph Campbell when he did Star Wars and looked at all the hero with a thousand faces. And it's like, well, that his Campbell was not writing a manual when he wrote that book for basic, you know, three act structure storytelling for a hero's journey.
No, no. He and was I'm trying not talking to talk about. Right. But his core narrative, like the thing that he said most often was that all of these myths from all of these cultures are essentially the same.
Yeah, that they have a lot of commonalities.
He went further than that, though. He went further than saying they had a lot of commonalities, and he said that they are essentially the same and that they are the result of a shared human experience. My, like, 22-year-old sitting in comparative mythology, like, stoner head was blown by that. But it's not demonstrably true when you go deeper than Samson and Hercules.
What is Aquaman's job? So at the time the movie starts, and they make reference to it briefly, that he has already done, he's done some casual heroing. Does he work at the lighthouse? Does he work on the docks? Like, we know he drinks and he lives on the coast.
Yeah, we don't need to know.
I guess, like, we don't.
He's Aquaman.
He's Aquaman.
He talks to the fishes.
I just love Momoa so much in the movie.
Yeah, he's fantastic. He's like, he's so compelling on screen, which is, like, fully half, if not more, of what makes this movie good.
I completely agree. I think he's half of why it works, and the other half is because James Wan, the director, again, like, calibrates everything so carefully to Momoa's persona.
Talk to me about James Wan, because I don't know shit about this guy.
He, you've probably seen some of his movies. He spent most of his career doing horror. This is only his second action film. He started as the Saw guy. He directed and I think co-wrote the first Saw movie. I believe he stayed on as a producer for the rest of the series, but didn't really direct any more of them. He made the two Insidious movies. He directed a pretty cool little movie called Death Sentence. That movie's great, but the things that really that I love of James Wan's prior to Aquaman are the two Conjuring movies. Both of those Conjuring films where he worked with Patrick Wilson are so good, such like classic, terrifying, like old Hollywood horror. And then he did Fast 7. Fast and Furious 7. Furious 7 is the title. He did Furious 7. Like, he employs a lot of the same visual tricks from Fast 7 in Aquaman. The montage of somebody putting together their equipment and getting ready for a mission is repeated visually the same way when we see Black Manta putting together his suit for the first time, with the camera circling around him while there's, like, a music video playing. A lot of the same visual trickery. But so, yeah, after Fast 7... he came on for Aquaman, and it's tonally not like anything else he's done before.
It's so much fun. He just understands what fun is.
Yeah. And again, like, it's not like we can talk about this in the same way that you can talk about, like, Black Panther, which, while none of the Marvel movies are auteurist, or can ascribe to the auteur theory, which is that, like, a director is the singular author of a film. Because the Marvel movies are also made by machine. But like Black Panther, you could maybe make an argument for that because Ryan Coogler has such a specific vision in his other films that comes through very strongly in that one. And he's making a statement with that movie that is very much a piece of his entire body of work. This one isn't in any way that way, except that it's not specific. It's not specific in the pantheon of these current crop of DC movies to James Wan's body of work, but it is specific to itself. Which, like, is the thing I just keep coming back to. It is an Aquaman movie. There are gags in it that you could not transplant to any other superhero movie. Like, one of my favorites is when Mira saves Momoa in the big trident fight, the first one with Orm. She saves him by using her hydrokinesis powers to create an air tunnel through the sea that sweeps up Orm laterally and then takes a hard 90-degree turn and drops him 50 feet through the air, in which he has no, like, Atlantean, you know, fast swimmy powers. He falls hard onto his back on the rock,
yep.
And then she closes the tunnel and drops all of that water on him and slams him. Like, it's a great gag that you could only do in an Aquaman movie. Whereas in a lot of these movies, some of the fights or some of the chases, like, they feel very interchangeable. There is a foot chase in Black Panther that is similar to another Black Panther foot chase in Captain America Civil War, which is extremely similar to a superpowered foot chase in Avengers Age of Ultron. Like, this one is so specific to what it is,
right,
because it's Aquaman and because it's Momoa.
We sure had a lot to say about a movie that's just, like, kind of dumb and fun.
It is kind of dumb and fun, but people need dumb and fun. Apparently people don't want movies that I think are funny but are actually about the, you know, how the bonds in our relationships are extremely tenuous and that we should hang on to the people around us and value them for as long as they're here. People need
movies,
fun.
But sometimes they take a toll.
It's true. This movie does not take a toll. This is the rare movie that I recommend to people where, like, I wouldn't say this, but between you and me, Jamie, since nobody else is listening, this is actually a movie where you can turn your brain off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would recommend turning your brain off with this here Lambrusco.
I would recommend that as well.
All right, Scotty Too Hottie.
James.
Take us home. What recommendations do you have for us for things that we need to be watching?
Well, something I watched recently that I had a terrific time with, and that, Jamie, this is actually right up your alley. We may do a future episode on it, is a 2020 film starring Mads Mikkelsen and directed by Thomas Vinterberg. It's a Danish film called Another Round. Four high school teachers launch an experiment, or they claim it's an experiment, about microdosing with alcohol. They look at, like, Hemingway as an example, and this like, supposed actual scientific paper that says that the human body is 0.05% blood alcohol content too low. And so their experiment is Monday to Friday, like 9 to 5, we will drink and to see how microdosing with alcohol affects our performance at work and our personalities. The performances are all great. It's very funny. It's not judgmental. You never feel like you're getting, like, beaten down with some kind of message about alcohol consumption. It has a very fair portrait that highlights the bad stuff and the good stuff, and it's a ball, and the soundtrack slaps too. Another round, I watched it via virtual cinema through one of the independent nonprofit theaters that are working with indie distributors to make sure that movies still find an audience while theaters are closed. By the time this episode drops, you should be able to find it on any number of VOD services.
That sounds right up my alley,
It's very up your alley.
I didn't
alley.
Know that microdosing of alcohol was a thing that we could, like, yeah. try and study. That I just know that when I drink at work, I'm better at dealing with customers.
Certainly without any negative side effects whatsoever.
I always performed my job with aplomb. Anyway, I would just like to say, try and find a little bit of normalcy for yourself, and make sure that you can stay sane. And I think sometimes a part of that, and this is selfish because I'm a part of the restaurant industry, is going out to eat. So you can't go out, support your local restaurant by getting takeout and call them up and order and go pick it up. These delivery apps are becoming a huge problem for fiscal solvency. For restaurants, they can take from 20 to 30% of the total.
Jesus.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. So if you're doing takeout and you haven't already drunk a bottle of wine, think about hopping in your car and picking up the food.
Nice. That's a good plug. All right, so for next time on currently still unnamed podcast in which two blowhards bloviate about movies and wine pretentiously, we will be watching the 2016 Sundance sensation Swiss Army Man, directed by the Daniels, two filmmakers, both named Daniel, first name, no family relation. Prior to this, their biggest claim to fame was the Turn Down for What video. This is a magical realism survival buddy comedy in which Paul Dano is stranded on a desert island when the corpse of Daniel Radcliffe washes up on shore. 5 minutes into the movie, Paul Dano is riding this flatulent body like a jet ski to another island closer to the mainland, and then the body starts talking, and they become best buds as he uses the Swiss Army Man corpse to survive this horrible situation and get back to civilization. As the filmmaker said, and I think a Sundance interview, they said, we wanted to make a movie that in the beginning there was a fart and at the end it made you cry. And I swear to God, Jamie, it was successful.
That sounds so far up my alley. I'm very excited.
I'm shocked you've never seen it before. It is such a Jamie movie.
You recommended it to me when it came out. I recall this. And I never did because I went through, as we will probably expound upon further as this podcast goes on, a period where I did not watch a lot of movies. But I'm excited for this one. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Swiss Army Man, The Daniels, 2016. What are we drinking with it?
I already
it?
Know the pair.
Well, hang on. Let me give them the business.
Okay.
So the descriptive words I would give you for this, it is a film that is sweet. It is grotesque. It is irreverent. It's also sincere, kinetic, and it's farty. It has a farty
it's
butt.
Farty butt. All right. So we're going to drink Pella Verga, which is a grape native to the Piedmont region of Italy. I know we've been very Italy heavy, but just prepare for that because I like Italian wine. It is a producer called Castello di Verduno, located in the town of Verduno. This is a super, super light, floral, sort of ethereal kind of, I don't know exactly the best way to put it in context to this movie, but it's a really fun wine that also has like a great deal to take serious about it.
Mm. So one more time, what is that wine
this
called?
This is the Castello di Verduno Pella Verga. The wine is called Bassadone. It is from Piedmont, Italy.
Well, James, do you want to sign off, wrap it up? Anything you want to put a bow on?
I don't know. I feel like we put a really good bow on it. Everybody, it is and always will be, I'm sure, a pleasure to sit here and rap about wine and movies, despite Scott's bloviating.
And I'm sure that everyone enjoying my bloviating has done so in spite of Jamie's bloviating. Yeah, Jamie, where can people find all your bloviations and opinions and hottest of takes?
On my Instagram, at OrdinairePierre.
And you can find me and my crankiness about movies and also the current state of the world being on fire, basically only on Twitter, at Old Man S. Hudson. My last note is I'll take back everything bad I've ever said about HBO Max, Warner Brothers feature films, so long as I get a 10-part HBO limited series about Octopus Drummer.
I'm in for Octopus Drummer 10-part series. Love y'all.
Bye, James.
Bye.
I'm stopping the recording. Meow.